Hello and welcome to the Tip of the Iceberg podcast. I'm Ashley Nickel with the Packer and PMG, and we have with us today Hugo Hayes, Global Director of Compliance and Food Safety for Fifes. Hugo, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Ashley, for having me.
Absolutely. And for anybody listening who happened to attend our first ever Sustainable Produce Summit back in September of 2020, Hugo was with us talking about social responsibility on a really dynamic panel that was part of that event. And we're going to delve a little bit more into that topic today. The Packer is doing a social responsibility content series. And so this is part of that. So we're excited, Hugo, to get your expertise. We'll start with a simple question, but maybe not an easy question, which is, how do you define kind of what is the scope of social responsibility?
Social responsibility is part of a bigger thing. It's part of CSR, it's part of sustainability, really. So you can't, I think anyway, really separate social responsibility from responsibility to the community or responsibility to the environment or responsibility to society, really. If you look at it from our point of view in compliance, well, then it's basically a section within a standard that deals with the questions that are related to workers, to how they feel, to whether you're fulfilling the ethical based code requirements, for example. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, and like you said, it seems like the people part of it is probably the go-to connotation for a lot of folks when they hear that term social responsibility. And what I'm wondering is, how does a company go from, you know, prioritizing people, but maybe not in a very structured way, to really, you know, having an intentional strategy around, hey, this is what we're going to do. These are the specific things, you know, how we're going to pursue social responsibility.
Yes, I'd like to think that perhaps this is part of just the way things are evolving normally, and the consumers are the ones that push you or that start talking about these different things with the clients, and the clients ask their suppliers, and the suppliers ask their suppliers, and it just goes down the supply chain. But again, we are also consumers ourselves, so we're not just farmers. You know, we're also part of society, part of community. So we also hear these things, and we expect it from, perhaps if we're not talking about food, we're expecting it from, I don't know, manufacturers of things that we, other things that we buy at, for our homes. So it's basically, in the end, society, like they say, the tide lifting all boats, bringing the social compliance into farming as well as it goes into other industries. So how do you go from being sort of caring to being more structured? Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I think the way you would normally go around things, or the way it's happened actually, is that we just get asked to do things by our clients. And we get asked, we have so many different clients, so we get asked lots of different things. And then we try to streamline those and align them so that we're not repeating or we're not doing the same thing several times over for different people. We try to integrate it within our systems. And to do that, we have used the certification standards as a guideline to start with, at least, to see right what are the basic things that we need to be looking at and achieving, and then okay, how do we do that, and then how do we prove that we're doing it, and how do we make sure that we're also aware of what the next thing that people are asking us to do is, and how can we then put our point of view across and maybe make it sensible. Sometimes the ambitions are too high or something's just too difficult to achieve initially, so you've got to work towards them. Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad you brought up certifications, because I remember, again from our conversation back in September, I recall you saying that, some of the European markets are a lot more, there's a lot more expectations of having those certifications to really, back up and third party verification and some of those things. And I'm curious, where would you say the US is in that regard, and how do you see things, changing in the coming years?
Yeah, so to be able to get that message up the chain, you need really good communication between the different members of that chain. So I think I always go back to it, but I think Global Gap is a really good example because you have in the same room retailers and farmers or farmer representatives. And that's when you can have a rich discussion about, this is what I want and this is what I can get, deliver. And that has been happening with Global Gap for over 20 years. So they have their finger on the pulse regarding new trends. They now have a system where you just have a plug and play module, so to speak, which is an add-on or a bolt-on for different things like biodiversity is now the latest one, but they have one for social as well. And in that way, yeah, retailers in Europe have been able to feed into that quite well. Whereas I remember when I was working for Global Gap, the difficulty with the US was more related to the restrictions that there were in terms of people getting together to discuss pre-competitive issues. There was always the fear of, well, are we breaking any laws? Are we going to be held liable for monopolistic behavior and things like that? So that I think is what set the course for the US being a bit more independent in terms of different retailers asking for different things and not necessarily aligning so much. So you have a wider variation, I feel, of some retailers asking for a lot and actually positioning themselves as that being their added value, and other retailers basically going for the basics, the minimum. But I think now we probably find that most retailers are already asking for more than they were a few years ago. So I think that the forum for discussion is very important, and you have it, for example, in the US, I think. More advanced in terms of microbiological contamination issues and things like that, but perhaps not so much on the, or it's a bit more disaggregated or less brought together in terms of the social and the social responsibility discussions. Yeah.
And what are you seeing from retailers as far as kind of how they're communicating about what they're asking in terms of social responsibility from their suppliers? How are they communicating that to consumers right now? Or is that like now they're sort of laying the groundwork for when those questions come, then they can say, yeah, actually, we've been working on this. This is what we're doing. Where are they in terms of kind of putting that out there with a bit more a bit more proactively, maybe.
It's a good question. I haven't lived in Europe for 7 years now, so I don't go into the supermarkets and see the messages that you would normally get, except when I travel to the US or to Europe. But from what I know from my colleagues, clients are bringing in the sustainability department into the closer to the buying decision, so to speak. So when you're making a purchasing decision from a client, they will bring in the CSR department closer to the decision point than before, anyway. And I think that's going to become, in the end, you have financial decisions or financial performance, but you have non-financial performance, which is being more and more, it's weighing more and more in the balance. So I think that's becoming more important. From how do the retailers communicate to us? Well, some retailers have supplier conferences, and those are very useful because they lay out to a huge group of people in the room who are basically competitors, but who are there receiving messages or receiving the expectations in a non-competitive area. So they talk about CSR, they talk about food safety, they talk about security, things like that. And CSR is prominent in those discussions. So, well, that's one way. Then obviously when you're presenting yourself to a tender, then you have to fill out different requirements. Those requirements are more and more related to CSR. There is a platform in the US which is facilitating data sharing on food safety, which is used, which we're asked to use more and more by retailers. And then there is SEDEX, which is the platform that is used for smetter audits. And those are also being used more by retailers, not so much, or not only the platform, but also the reports. So they ask for the smetter report, which is incredibly granular. And then they can use that to have a kind of radar or pie chart that shows you where you are on the risk, how far away you are from the risk of perhaps not complying, and then they treat you differently regarding that. So they audit you more, or they ask you for more detail.
And what are some of the key components when it comes to, you know, social responsibility, particularly kind of focusing on like worker well-being, for instance?
It's okay. Interesting question. It's ranged. Yeah, it's gone. It's moved. It keeps moving a little bit, the target. But lately, it's interesting that at least to us, it's become more and more evident that human rights is the common language that people are beginning to speak about. So initially, human rights, when it was agreed upon in the United Nations 1940s, was a smaller amount of human rights than we have now recognized. And then it's become wider, and it's become more into or more linked to business. So since 2011, with the Ruggie report, et cetera, they said, well, business is actually responsible for meeting the human rights of the workers. And since then, everything begins to really fall into place, because it comes down to basic human rights and talking a common language.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in terms of where the focus is, it depends on the country. So some countries have, that we work in 12 countries in Latin America, and depending on where you are, it could be poverty, it could be related, it could be security related, it could be the fact that in that country there might be lack of legislation on some basic things. So in Fives, what we've done is, and this is something that is actually being regulated in the EU as a requirement, companies need to start doing a human rights impact assessment.
Oh.
And to do that, you basically look at all the human rights that apply to you. I mean, there are, I don't know, 20 odd human rights, and of those, perhaps 12, 14 apply within your business. And then you do a survey within your business of how those human rights are applying within your company. And then you identify which ones are the higher ranking risks, and then you deal with those. So this is now legislation in the EU, and it's for certain size companies. And it's a good way, it's a good roadmap for you to follow, really. It brings it down to basic human decency in the end.
And I was thinking about, like you said, there's a variety of different certifications out there, and some retailers are going with some, and some are asking for others. And I was curious, because obviously at this point, everybody's familiar with like food safety audits. What does a social responsibility audit look like? You know, what does it take for a company to prepare for that? And then what's kind of the process of that as it unfolds?
Okay. Well, so it covers certain areas, but the one of the big changes that you have from a food safety audit is that you have closed door interviews with your workers.
Okay.
So the external auditor comes in and says, right, I've got to do so many audits, so many interviews of your workers. So they pick a certain number of names from your payroll, and they interview those. And then they also go out in the field and find anybody and just interview them and find their name and trace them back to see if they're on the payroll, for example. And so they ask them a whole load of different questions, which they then use the results of those questions or of those interviews to try and determine how compliant the company is or how far along the road of compliance it is. And obviously there will be some people who may, I don't know, have had a bad experience with the company and will give the company a bad rap, but then they take, then maybe the rest of the people will give the company a really nice reputation. So they, so the important thing there is the auditors that do the CSR, that do the social auditing, need to be very experienced and very skilled in being able to see through the real facts and bring a conclusion to the whole bunch of interviews that they've had. And then they find on the things that they've identified, they drill down within your systems to see that your systems are managed okay, that you're training your people correctly, that your induction process is effective, because you could say you're doing a lot of training and then it all goes over the top of people's heads because maybe they can't even understand the language you're talking in, or they can't read and write in some cases. So it's a process. You've got to move towards getting your workers on board with a lot of these things. For example, another thing that changes is that in the opening and closing in meetings, you will have, or you'll be asked to have the union representative there, or the worker representative, worker representative delegate. So that's a little bit different. And then the standards go into social areas rather than food safety. So.
Now that seems like it might be, you know, for maybe a company that hasn't had that kind of certification before and they're looking at going that direction because they have a customer requesting it or something along those lines. That seems like it might be kind of a scary, you know, first step, just that level of, you know, transparency the first time a company goes through an audit like that.
I think you're right. I mean, some people might consider it impertinent questioning sometimes. it's also, some companies are very good to their workers, and if anybody challenges that that they might not be being good, then they say, well, how am I not being good? And so you've got to put into actions and words and get people to talk for you. And sometimes things are unspoken, yes, within a company. And you've got to start talking about these things, unpacking them and getting feedback that is real. So yeah, it's a bit of a change, mindset change, I suppose, mm-hmm. when you're going into having people poking around on the social aspects of your company.
Yeah, well, and like you mentioned, it's probably something where, you know, even though, you know, depending on what the circumstances are, it could be painful, you know, a little bit at first, maybe if someone's doing their very first one or something like that. But like you said, it probably starts a lot of conversations that needed to be had. And one of the things that, you know, of course, we've heard from you guys and other companies that have some of these certifications are that kind of the workforce development and empowerment element of it, you know, just bringing those voices more into, you know, kind of the broader conversations about the company can really have some huge benefits. Well, what are some of those things that kind of go along with that?
Yes, the people who are doing the work are the ones who know how things could be done better, the best. Normally, because when you set an objective of so many, I don't know, fruit picked per hour, that's your objective as a business. But how to actually do it and how to do it without you know, wrenching your elbow or whatever. That is, what is the worker will know instinctively what is maybe not doing him good in the long run. And then when you have that discussion, you obviously then perhaps need to have somebody who is skilled in health and safety to tell you, or in ergonomics, or in productive economics, etc., to determine which is the best way, or what is the best movement, or what is the way the most productive and efficient way to do things. So yes, it does open up once you start talking about things. I mean, a lot of farmers already do that. They're best interested in getting the highest productivity, but also maintaining their labor force happy, and a happy worker produces more. So, but yes, sometimes when you're in a big company, it's difficult to get messages across. And one of the things that some of these standards ask for is to have a good feedback mechanism. So you have, for example, grievance mechanisms that are anonymous, so that people don't feel that they might be threatened or whatever, or have repercussions. And these are getting more and more sophisticated. Actually, you can have a company that calls the worker up every month with yes no questions. Are you being mistreated? Yes, no. Do you have enough water to drink? The temperature's too high, I don't know, yeah. Things that would be, or do you have good accommodation? And then that doesn't necessarily show you up as a company, but it helps you use that information to say, all right, there's one of these questions that's coming back as really bad. Let's deal with it, because it's obviously something we haven't picked up and needs addressing. So you can automatize it as well. It's part of your KPIs in your company.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, because like you mentioned, there's a number of different audits and certifications out there. What's kind of your expectation on how the prevalence of those might increase in the U.S. market in particular in the coming years? Because I feel like we hear a little bit more about them and a little bit more about them. But when I go to my local grocery store, like, you know, you might see one or two, but it's not necessarily, super visible at this point. So I'm curious kind of just what you see in the coming years on that.
Yeah, good point. Once you have a company that is reporting on non-financial performance, and it's a legal requirement, that also becomes a factor when you're thinking as an investor or as a shareholder. And it's not just, you know, will you buy their products or not, but will you invest, or will you make their share price go up? So in that way, it can affect a company whether they have good performance or not. And that's where, in theory anyway, private standards come along and they fill a gap, which is basically the gap between the expectations of the society and what the government laws are regulating. So there's a lag always before legislation takes over what society is wanting. And so that gap is in some subjects, for example, on food safety, we have much tighter regulations on traceability, for example, which was one of the first things that private standards started asking for. And so that part of a private standard may not necessarily be included anymore, because it's legislation, so you have to comply with it. And with the social standards, etc., initially there's a huge proliferation of standards, and then they start consolidating as well. A bit like, you know, the car industry used to have hundreds of makes and now we have few. And so it's a natural maturation cycle, I think, hopefully. And this is what we hope anyway, that, you know, we won't have a huge number of multiplying ethical standards, because in the end, they're basically the same foundations. So, and our work in the industry, all of us farmers, all of us producers, we need to make it abundantly clear to our clients that if possible, we should have more consolidation within the standards, because each standard incorporates more audits, more visits, more days spent receiving people to on your farm, more work trying to fit different answers to the same questions. So what we're doing in Fife, for example, is participating in Global Gap and try and make sure that there is that common language in bringing together, trying to bring together Rainforest Alliance, Global Gap, fair trade as much as possible. It does give you an added value as a supplier if you've got those different standards, but in the end, it also brings a little bit of cacophony and dissonance in the system. So yeah, a clearer message, you know, a clearer or bigger or more harmonized standard will give you a better, stronger message, I think.
That makes sense, because I imagine it's, you know, from a consumer education standpoint too, it seems like asking the consumer a lot to understand, you know, what these 6 or 7 or 8 different, you know, standards are that one retailer might ask for this and one might ask for that. And, you know, one might have this certification, one might have that certification. And I know consumer education is something that we hear a lot about in produce on a number of different topics, but it's that seems to always be kind of an uphill battle.
Yeah, I think finally my expectation would be that we have consumers never expected their food that they bought in the supermarket to be unsafe. And yet you have lots of food safety standards. Okay, yes. But that shows that maybe some food was unsafe. So in practice, it's a non-competitive issue. It's a pre-competitive issue. And that will also become the case with social standards. Surely a consumer, when he goes into the supermarket, doesn't expect that what he's buying is actually making somebody suffer or somebody have a low quality of life. So that for that expectation to reach the point where there's an extra, where the price they expect or the consumer expects or accepts a higher price. Yeah, that's where we want to get, I guess. Because higher price doesn't necessarily mean more sustainable either. But when we come to talk about wages, then it's money, and money in the end impacts the price of the product. So one of the big issues lately has been living wage, and that basically means a worker having enough money to cover off their basic needs, mm-hmm. Which are often not covered by a minimum wage. A minimum wage is a more political tool that has not always has a contact or connection with technical issues. So living wage is a newer concept, which is implying basically paying more for your product in the end. There's ways you can tweak it where you can have more higher productivity perhaps, or you can have maybe lower cost of living, but in the end it does imply having higher costs. So
what's been your impression of kind of the willingness to pay, you know, both on the part of the customer and then of the end consumer as well, for all right, you know, are we willing to pay more because we know that, you know, we have some verification that this was, you know, produced in a socially responsible manner, or kind of where is that message and kind of in the acceptance of that?
Again, it's changing. We see now, so in the EU and specifically in Germany, they're talking about, and I'm not sure what stage the legislation is at, but the legislation is going to make the end seller of a product responsible for social compliance in the chain of supply. So this is a big driver where the retailer will try and make sure, first of all, establish, you know, how much is being or how much compliance on social there is in their supply chain, and then try and bring it up so that they don't have a problem with the law. So we have found lately that retailers are wanting to talk to us about, for example, making a little pilot or finding out, you know, what we can do. There's work, for example, done on what tools you can use to determine if you, how far away you are from the living wage, or are you at the living wage, or in what countries do you have that. Also, the Global Living Wage Coalition, which is made up of a group of NGOs, including Rainforest Alliance, for example, they have a methodology, the Anchor methodology, and they go around country by country saying, okay, these are the costs that we found in, and they normally do it in a certain area of a country if the country is a big country. The latest one, for example, has been, I think it's rural workers in Sao Paulo state in Brazil, for example. And they say, this is how much the worker should get to be able to cover for a standard size family, which is an argument because different families are sizes in different countries, for covering a healthy diet, which includes the typical, I don't know, rice, beans, a little bit of meat. And so they calculate all this up into a costing as a minimum. I think it's one beer every 2 weeks. So it's very conservative. no cigarettes. And then they look at a decent sized house with, for example, I don't know, wooden framed windows. So it's very quite specific, concrete floor instead of dirt floor. And sometimes they look at dirt floor, I think, and then they add all this up and they say, okay, this is what it costs to live. And they could include little bit of discretionary spending for and a little bit of saving. What is the cost of schooling? What is the cost of medical care? You know? They put that in there, and then they say, right, for that, well, you need to get so much wages for a wage earner in a family. And then, okay, how much are you paying? And then you look at an Excel document where you've put in all your different pay rates that might vary, piece rate, etc. per hour. And then you have a graph that tells you, okay, your lowest paying are maybe at this stage regarding living wage, and your highest paying are above. And what can we do? And then we reach a discussion, what can we do? And that's basically where we're at, I think, right now. Okay, the money's going to come in. Then you've got other problems where, for example, you've only got, you're discussing with one client and you're selling to five clients. So what about the other clients? Another issue is, sorry if I'm going too much into detail.
Oh, no, this is fascinating.
But then if you've got laws in a country where you've set the wage, you can't go back down afterwards. So next year that client leaves you and high and dry, and then you can't go back down to the wage that's set by law because it's set a precedent. So there's a myriad of things. Also, it depends on, you know, the productivity of the farm according to the weather. You might have heavens forbid, but a tornado that wipes out your plantation. Then what do you do then? So it's complex, but you need to be, understanding where these things are going so that you can try and manage them.
Yeah, complex, I think, is definitely the word that comes to mind. And obviously for you guys, like you mentioned, operating in all these different countries, it looks different every single place, I'm sure.
Yes. You also have countries that are classified by risk. According to the standards. The standards say, okay, we've looked at the World Bank classification of risks, and we say your country is in orange and your country is in green. Okay, your country, like Costa Rica, is normally in the less risky countries. We will audit you only once every, well, we will only audit 10% of our suppliers in that country. Whereas another country that might, on a general scale, be more risky, say Colombia, for example, we will come and audit you a lot. And for example, in some areas of Colombia, there is it's a different. So some parts of the country are less risky than others, but the whole picture gives you a a risk level that is higher than what you might have in your production areas. So we've got to work on that. And with our human rights impact assessment, we try and go more into detail about the regions that we're working with. However, some of the data that you can use for risk classification of a country is is only available at a national level. So,
that's so interesting. Well, we could probably talk about all this for a lot longer, I'm sure, but I want to be respectful of your time. Yeah, I probably have more questions. Maybe we can do a part two of this at some point down the road. But for now, anything else that you wanted to make sure to mention today before we wrap things up?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, and I hope I haven't bored any of your readers or listeners.
Not at all.
But it is getting more complex. We find that compliance, for example, before we were classified as, okay, the sustainability department. Well, now we've divided into sustainability and compliance because it just gets, you go down so many different forks in the road that you end up sort of having to have more time, more resources, more dedication to that. And I think perhaps that's what companies need to think about, that it's not just, it hasn't been just producing for a long time, but it's producing and it's also, being a steward of what you do and communicating it as well, so that you don't give the wrong impression or you get the right impression across.
Yeah. Well, Hugo, thank you again for joining us. I think this has been great to give kind of the big picture, some of the global trends, down to some of the nitty-gritty details and things that make this complex, like we said. Not easy to execute, not easy to figure out, all right, you know, what is the standard? Because there's quite a few of them out there right now, but certainly something we will continue to watch, keep an eye on. It'll be really neat, I think, to see how this evolves in the coming years. So thank you again. Thanks to everyone for listening. And we'll see everybody next time on the Tip of the Iceberg podcast.